All right, it's recording. All right, so just tell me, like, the basics of Grandpa's story.
Isn't there, like, some kind of introduction you're supposed to do? Like, get my name and all of that?
I guess, yeah. So I'm here with my dad, Stephen Vapolis, interviewing him about my grandpa Tony Anthony Vapolis, and his time, or his experience in the Korean War.
You got it.
All right.
So if I'm going to tell a story, I guess you got to start with the background. Grandpa Tony was the youngest of 11 kids. He had 8 brothers and 2 sisters. And most of his brothers fought in World War II. So he had a brother in the Navy, he had a brother in the Army Air Force, he had a brother in the Marines, he had one of his brothers who still lived in Greece was in, somehow he wound up in the Belgian Army. I don't really know the story of that, but after Greece was occupied by the Germans, he was somehow wound up in the Belgian Army. There was another brother who stayed in Greece and kind of fought with the resistance, which basically means that they spent a lot of time cutting down all the copper construction wire that the Germans would hang, and then they would burn the rubber coating off and melt the copper down and then sell it back to the Germans and then just keep doing that. That was kind of their thing there. But anyhow, his brothers in all sort of different parts of the armed forces had a lot of different experiences. The worst was his brother Marino, who was in the Marines, and he was an island hopper on the Pacific campaign. So if you've learned anything about that, you'll know that that was a horrific part of World War II. He went kind of from island to island, a lot of crazy fighting against the Japanese, until he was at Guadalcanal, it's called, and he was shot with a machine gun, and he got shot, and it went in one side of his hip and came out the other. And that kind of ended the war for him. And then he had another, there was one brother that was in between him and the other ones who got drafted, and he was in the occupation force in Japan in between World War II and the Korean War. And then Grandpa Tony was the youngest. So when the Korean War started, his brothers all told him, they just said, just keep your head down and don't say anything. The day his draft papers, I guess I can say this is probably illegal, but he's passed away, so it doesn't matter. The day his draft papers came in the mail, they said, okay, you run down to the Air Force recruiting office and you volunteer there. And they're going to ask you if you were drafted, and you say, nope. So that's what he did. And the reason was his brothers told him that that the Air Force was a new part of the armed forces. They formed it after World War II. It was a spin-out from the Army. There was the Army Air Corps, but people realized that fighting in planes was so important that they were going to make the Air Force its own branch of the military. So his brother said that they had the most money, they had the best budget, and they were going to have the best food. So that's what your grandpa did. He went down and volunteered for the Air Force and joined the Air Force rather than get drafted into the Army. You know, because they came from a big family and as a poor family, Grandpa was pretty handy. So he wound up getting pulled into mechanic school, and he wound up being a mechanic, and he worked on B-29 bombers. So that's what he was trained to do. He was down in San Antonio. He's got a lot of good stories about how he had to get from Ohio down to San Antonio. He hitchhiked both ways across the country more than once. And then he had to he deployed from San Francisco. He got on a boat and rode the boat over to Japan, which is where he was stationed, and working on the plane he worked on was a B-29 bomber. And he was an engine mechanic. And so he spent the first almost year of the war doing that, fixing planes. But growing up, he was always a caddy at a golf course in Ohio, and he was a pretty good golfer. And so when he was there, they had this all-services golf tournament. And your dad, or my dad, signed up for that. Your grandpa signed up for that and ended up winning the tournament. And so it was for enlisted men and officers and everything, and he won the whole thing. So then immediately after that, he got reassigned from working on planes to a golf course in Japan that that the U.S. had kind of taken away from Japan and sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but commandeered for themselves. And so Grandpa was in charge of running the golf course, but really what he did was he gave lessons all day to officers and then just kind of served as an overall golf course manager. So he was in charge of all the people that mowed the grass and took care of everything. But yeah, so he spent the rest of the war then working at a golf course, which when you think about it, is a pretty good way to spend a war. And, you know, he was there from a very poor family, you know, so he spent all day, and most of the staff at the golf course were Japanese people, so he learned to speak Japanese, working with them all day long. And he gave lessons to a lot of famous generals, including one who became really famous later on, a guy named Westmoreland, who if you studied the Vietnam War, you he became sort of famous slash infamous for some of his strategies during the Vietnam War. But your dad knew him, or my dad knew him pretty well from helping him learn to play golf. Some other interesting stories. And that's how he met Westmoreland, because he was in charge of like some paratroopers or special forces or something. And they used to use the golf course for training. So they would jump out of planes and then land on the golf course. So whenever they were doing this training exercise, they had to run out on the course and take down all the flag sticks out of the holes. And they had to replace all the out-of-bounds stakes with buried tires so that when the paratroopers came down, that there was nothing they were going to hurt themselves on. Let me think what else. So he did that all the way through the war. And then towards the end of the war, because he was working with officers all the time and they came to really like him and respect him, they wanted your grandpa to go back and go to officer candidate school, and they said they would push it through and get him promoted and made into an officer if he completed all the training and everything. And Grandpa Tony said no, that his plan was to go back home and go to college on the GI Bill, which was a really neat program that the government offered back then, where if you went off and fought in war and you were a veteran, when you came home, the government would pay for your college education. And that was really the only way that that he was going to be able to go to college. He was the first of all of his brothers to go to college after one of his other brothers went. So there were only two of them of the 11 kids that went to college. But your dad was, and my dad was the first in the whole family to go to college. And then one of his brothers saw what he was doing and decided he wanted to do that too. That was the one, another one who had served in the military as well. So they both were able to go to college on the GI Bill. And again, yeah, because he spent the whole war playing golf, basically. He was a pretty good golfer by that point. A funny story about that, I guess I'll rewind back to the beginning. When Grandpa Tony, because they were so poor, they didn't have much food. They kind of grew up in a rural part of Ohio. They didn't have much food. When he graduated from college, from high school, he was 5'7" and 135 pounds. When he went to the Air Force, that's what he always said. Like, it was the first time in his life that he was getting three meals a day, every day. And so he started growing like crazy. And by the time he left the Air Force, he was 6'2" and 210 pounds. So he got quite a bit bigger while he was in the Air Force. And it turns out that being bigger helped him get a lot better at golf. So when he came out of college and then came out of the Air Force and went to college on the GI Bill, he wound up being on the golf team at Pitt. But because he was a veteran, he was older than most of the college kids at that point. So he was, 26 or something at the time, and these other kids were 19. But that's while he was in college, he played golf for the University of Pittsburgh. But back then they used to just call it Pitt. One of the tournaments he was in when he was a senior, he played against a freshman from Ohio State whose name is Jack Nicklaus. So I don't know if you knew that Grandpa Tony played against Jack Nicklaus when Jack was like 19 and Grandpa Tony was like 28 or something at that point. So he was a lot older. He was just a fat kid that hit the ball really far. And if you see pictures of Jack Nicklaus in college, he was really fat. He weighed like 280 pounds or something. He was a big fat kid. He got a lot skinnier when he turned pro. So that's it. He's got, in terms of his, war experience, it's a lot different than other people. You hear my uncles tell some terrible stories about some of the fighting and stuff in World War II, but they would all make fun of Grandpa Tony because he had it so cushy. But they didn't really, when I say make fun of him, they were happy for him because they know how bad the war was, and they were happy that they helped him out and kind of hooked him up, getting him in the Air Force. So that's kind of the basics of it. I'm trying to think of some of the side stories that he would tell. There was because he ran a golf course, I was the only enlisted person in all of Japan that had his own Jeep. He was like, because I always had to do stuff for the golf course. And he was like, one of the things that he could do is he could get stuff through the PX, which is like the store that they would have on the Air Force Base. So they had their own supply chain, and so they would bring all these things over from the U.S., different kinds of things, and soldiers could buy them there, and it was relatively cheap. But he would buy all that stuff and then put it, load it up in his Jeep, and then he would drive into town, into Tokyo, and then he would kind of sell it all off and make a huge profit. But he wasn't doing it for pocket money. He was doing it, and then he would come back and buy golf clubs and golf balls and all of that for all the officers, and they all thought he was the greatest guy in the world for pulling that off, because he could get them all that stuff for basically nothing. I'm trying to think what else. There was another, he told another story about, a lot of times in that first year when he was working on planes, they were kind of in combat. So the bombers would come back and they would be, shot up and whatever. And so they would have to, he was like, we were turning them over really fast. But basically they would land, they would refuel them, they would put more bombs on them, they would fix them, make sure they were flying right, and they turn right back around and go drop more bombs. And that's like his only story that's sort of involved in violence, where they were, he was working on the engine, trying to tune something back up, it had an oil leak or something, and the guys were loading bombs on, and they dropped a big the bomb handlers, they had a special name for those guys, I don't remember what they were, but they were the ones that would roll the bombs out, and they had a special kind of jack that would push them up, and they'd hook them into the plane, and they screwed something up, and it dropped on the ground, and it started rolling across the tarmac, and everybody thought it was going to blow up, and he said he had to dive into a hole, but turned out it didn't blow up. But that was, I remember that story from him. Yeah, it's too bad that he's not around, because he was, Grandpa Tony could really tell stories. He was a really good storyteller. So he would have loved to sit and tell stories to you right now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's all of it. I don't know if you have any other kind of specific questions or anything you want me to cover, but that's the crazy story of Grandpa Tony's military career during the Korean War. The last thing I think I'll throw it as a prologue. I can remember him saying the name of the golf course, and I never thought about looking it up or anything, because, you know, when I was young and he would talk about it, there was no internet or anything like that. But the name just always kind of stuck in my head. And then this past year, watching the, wasn't the past year, maybe a couple years ago, watching the Olympics that were in Japan, and golf was a new event in the Olympics. They were playing at a course called Katsumigasaki, and that was the course that that Grandpa Tony worked at. So I recognized that name right away when they said it on TV. So I guess that I had never seen it before, but then seeing it on TV, it was a really, really nice course. So he definitely had a cushy job through the war.
Are there any more like in-depth like stories from like directly during the war that kind of like, I don't know, just like,
yeah, you know, so I mean, one of the problems is like when Grandpa would tell those stories, a lot of times I was young, so he would leave a lot of stuff out, but I can remember him talking about, you know, when bad things would happen and then they would have to go in, and I know one of his friends was a tail gunner who got killed, and I know he had to go and clean out, you know, when those planes, if you've ever seen what a B-29 looks like, it's pretty crazy. They're really big planes. Mm-hmm. And then they had gunners that were all over the place on it. So there was a ball turret that hung underneath the plane. And so a guy had to sit in there and he would spin around and shoot at planes that came at them from underneath. And then there was a tail gunner. So there was a guy who had to crawl down this tube all the way down the whole length of the plane. There was a little tunnel. You had to crawl down there and get into this little chair, and you had a gun and you would shoot out the back of the plane when guys were coming. And then they had what they called waist gunners. They were on either side of the plane and they shot out the sides of the plane. And then there was another, they called it a chin turret, that was kind of under the nose of the plane. So I guess that's why they call it a chin. It was so he would squeeze in between the pilot and the co-pilot and go down a little ladder, and there was a little seat under there, and he would shoot out there. So there were all these turrets all over the planes, and that was about the only way they really had to defend themselves from fighter planes who come after them. But I can remember he had a good friend who was a tail gunner, and I can remember him saying that he had to clean up the whole tail when the guy got killed. So I remember that story too. I can remember Grandpa was sad telling that story. Yeah. Yeah, that's about it. You know, I think he learned so many tricks being a mechanic in the Air Force, where you kind of had to figure things out. There was really nothing that your grandpa couldn't fix. But he could always get it fixed so that it would work, but it was never quite worked right. It was kind of a funny thing. Your grandma would get so mad at him. But and I can remember different times, like when we bought our first house, he was helping me fix the I had to put a new water heater in, and so he was helping me do that. And so we hooked the gas line up, and I was like, well, how would I know if it leaked? And he pulled out a lighter, and I was like, I thought it was going to blow everything up. But he's like, no, if you just hold the lighter around here. He said, if there's a leak, it'll catch on fire, and you'll see a little bit of fire come up. Just small little things like that. I had no idea that you could just do that. But, you know, if you called a company, they would never do that. They'd come out with some gas detector and charge you $500 and whatever. Mm-hmm. But he had all these old school ways of doing things. And the other thing, whenever you get in trouble, I know you had to go peel potatoes, so your grandma could peel potatoes as fast as you wanted to see. So that's the bulk of it. If you need some pictures, I know Grandma Ellie has some really good pictures. She's got one of him sitting on the wing of a plane. If you need any of those for your report, I can text her and ask her to send them.
Mm-hmm. I have another question about, like, how did he, like, go about fixing the planes? Like what would he...
Yeah, you know, so he knew how to work on cars, and I think plane engines back then, right, propeller engines were kind of internal combustion engines, so they had pistons and everything, just like a car. You know, jet engines today are a lot different than that. So I know he had to go to a school for like 6 months after basic training to learn how to be a mechanic. But, you know, it was a lot like working on a car. You know, you had, instead of, you know, you've heard of like cars like have 6 cylinders or 8 cylinders or 4 cylinders. I think those planes had something like 27 cylinders. So they had like 3 banks of 9 that were kind of all around. They call it a radial engine. They were kind of, what is it, 360, every 120 degrees around in a circle, and the pistons work to spin the propeller. I can remember other things, like he would talk about, like, those engines, you had to prime them to get them started, so that means you had to get the gas going. And he was like, before they would take off, he's like, they'd have to get up early and go, and they would get in the line, and you would grab the propeller and just walk it and push it forward, and then the next blade would come down, there'd be a guy behind you, and he'd grab that one, grab that blade and push it and walk it forward, and you just kept doing that in line, and then you would go back to the end, and you would keep walking, and you had to spin the propeller around like 10 or 15 times, and that would move the mechanical stuff inside the engine to get the gas and the oil flowing so that it was safe to start up. So they had to do that. That plane was really big. It had four propellers, you know, all the way across, and so they had to do that on every plane. And so that was a big part of the morning when they were going to go fly missions, was they had to get all the engines primed and ready to get started.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, other than that, I mean, I don't think his job from that standpoint was a whole lot different than, you know, your auto mechanic, right? You run engines. You know, the difference is those engines, they would fly long missions, and after... you know, how like in a car, after so many miles, you change the oil. For those kinds of planes, it was so many hours. They counted how many hours the engines were running. And after so many hours, you'd have to change the oil or change the filters or mm-hmm. change the belts or, you know, all kinds of different things like that. And then, you know, if something happened to the plane while it was flying, if it got shot up or whatever, then they'd have to take it all apart and figure out, all right, what got damaged, what we got to change, what's broken, and where can we get parts from. You know, they had planes that were too damaged, and then they just use them for spare, and they'd say, okay, well, we'll just need this one sitting over here, and if parts break on another plane, we need them, we'll come and yank them off of this one.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not, back then, again, sorry, that was a call just now. Not a whole lot different than an auto mechanic.
Mm-hmm. And then how are those planes like that he fixed, how are they used?
Yeah, they were all bombers. So they would fly them from Japan, and they'd fly missions over Korea and drop bombs. That's what they did. They were heavy bombers. If you go look on the internet, you could look up and see just how big they are and how many pounds bombs they carried and all of that. They were big planes.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had like a crew of 12, but I think they would carry a couple tons of bombs. And they had big bomb racks and then bomb bay doors that would open up. And there was a guy called a vomiteer who would look through a special aiming thing, and they would hit buttons and the bombs would just drop out. I don't know. A lot of what they did in Korea was what they prefer to sense as carpet bombing, which is you have a whole lot of planes with a whole lot of bombs, and usually like fire bombs or whatever, and you would just bomb a whole area and blow up everything in it. Tactical bombing where you were aiming for a specific factory or something like that, but you know, the Korean War was a little different. And you were just trying to bomb areas and kill everybody that you could.
And then, so Grandpa was always stationed in Japan, right?
Yeah, I mean, he did his initial training. I know that he did his initial training down in San Antonio, Texas. That was his basic training. And then I think he had to go to a different Air Force base in Texas, and that was where he learned to be a mechanic. It was the same place where they trained pilots. So it was like the pilot training place, but he was being trained to be a mechanic. That was a different, there were like, I think there were 5 Air Force bases in San Antonio or something like that. It was crazy back then. And so he moved there to learn that. And then I know that he deployed from San Francisco, because I can remember him telling me that, you know, when he had to go out there and they loaded everybody up on a big ship. And then he left the port in San Francisco, and from there went over. Yeah. There's someone at the door here, my man. I'm going to have to go around and see what's going on.
Okay.
Can you pause it and restart it, or how does that work? Yeah.